woman and gay, needing hours, me quiz, nay, I've said my one long gone. Hey, old son and gay, needing hours, me quiz, nay, I've said my one long gone. Hey, old thing of me, I needing hours, me quiz, nay, I've said my one long gone. Hey, oh, hey, oh, copy for no done, me the colors, me quiz, nay, I've seen him on one home gone. Hey, oh, hey, keep waiting, the man I do keep waiting, need me the colors, me quiz, nay, I've seen him on one home gone. Hey, oh, wake up in the key, God, why not you suggy way win?
And for those whom you love, now have some fun.
Miss Quaid, oh, one touch, Miss Quaid, oh, Miss Quaid, oh, Miss Quaid, oh, Kitty, Miss Quaid, oh, Amy, no, na, and not she, na, Miss Quaid, oh.
Turd was in the way of an implication. The first hymn that he sang called down the blessings of the cardinal directions, the manados of the cardinal directions, Gitche Manado in the sky, and Mother Earth. The second hymn invoked the presence and the guidance of the Miscuedo. I think that it's an entirely appropriate place to do that here, because the Miscuedo is the agent of guidance for us here today. Gordon mentioned the misgivings that he has about it, and the hopes that the Miscuedo and its presence will prove to have a salutary effect, that the Miscuedo will in fact be used for good. I just want to paraphrase the second hymn. I hope I don't do too much violence to it, although translation does that. It says, beautiful Miscuedo, supernatural Miscuedo, will this occasion bring good or evil? Miscuedo will answer. Well, how do we get from Lalemant, who was working in the Quebec area and who certainly was talking to the Montagnais, although he does not say it, to the Ojibwe, the Anishinaabe, at least intellectually, that is. Gordon described to you the small letter that Lalemant sent to his brother. We have additional evidence, as Gordon has indicated. In 1823, an expedition ordered by the then Secretary of War, J.C. Calhoun, explored the so-called West under the leadership of Major Stephen Long. As described by the historiographer of the expedition, Professor William Keating, who was a geologist, their interpreter supplied them with much information regarding the customs and beliefs of the Chippewa, who are numbered among the Ojibwe. The interpreter, Charles Bruce, half Chippewa, half white, was with the party between Fort Douglas and Fort William. He had been recommended to Major Long as one on whose assertions implicit reliance might be placed. Keating found him to be, in fact, truthful, but thought him not as intelligent as he was said to be, maybe a common failing. Keating therefore left out parts of Bruce's accounts that seemed to him to be ignorant or credulous. Those of us who are interested in anthropology wish that people would not do that. Those are the parts that are almost always most important. He did, however, include the following description of the Chippewa land of the dead and the mushroom diet there. He said, "The Chippewas believe that there is in man an essence, entirely distinct from the body. They call it Ochichog, and appear to apply to the qualities which we refer to the soul. They believe that it quits the body at the time of death and repairs to what they term Chekichami." That could be just a strange transliteration. This region is supposed to be situated to the south and on the shores of the great ocean. Previous to arriving there, they meet with a stream, which they are obliged to cross upon a large snake that answers the purposes of a bridge. Those who die from drowning never succeed in crossing this stream. They are thrown into it and remain there forever. Some souls come to the edge of the stream, but are prevented from passing by the snake that threatens to devour them. These are the souls of persons in a lethargy or trance. Being refused a passage, these souls return to their bodies and reanimate them. They believe that animals have souls, and even that inorganic substances such as kettles, etc., have in them a similar essence. In this land of souls, all are treated according to their merits. Those who have been good men are free from pain. They have no duties to perform. Their time is spent in dancing and singing, and they feed upon mushrooms, which are very abundant. The souls of bad men are haunted by the phantoms of the persons of things that they have injured. Thus, if a man has destroyed much property, the phantoms or the wrecks of his property obstruct his passage wherever he goes. If he has been cruel to his dogs or horses, they also torment him after death. The ghosts of those whom during his lifetime he wronged are there permitted to avenge their injuries. They think that when a soul has crossed the stream, it cannot return to its body, yet they believe in apparitions and entertain the opinion that the spirits of the departed will frequently visit the abodes of their friends in order to invite them to the other world and forewarn them of their approaching dissolution." Remember, that's Keating's writing of the transcription of the situation as he heard it from Bruce. That other Ojibwe, Anishinaabeg, also held the belief that mushrooms were the food of the dead is evident from a small story recounted by the Ojibwe artist Norval Morisot. He lives now in the area around Toronto. He's a contemporary, that is. Another time, this old elder, according to Morisot, dreamed he went to the far south to a place known to the Ojibwe, where Indians go after they die. Upon getting there, he saw Indians who had been dead a long time, having a great feast of mushrooms, and was offered some, but he did not accept the offer. The Indian believed that if he did eat, he would not return to his human form or the place where he fell asleep. In 1969, a book of Ojibwe folktales was published, apparently a retelling and modification of originals related to the author, a man named Schwartz, by Norval Morisot. This is in print, and one could get it if one wished. Two tales dealt with magic mushrooms. One was called Ishkamatuk and the Thunderbird Boy, and the second was called The Magic Mushrooms. The former describes the use of a gray mushroom powder as part of a sorcerer's kit of chemical tricks. This powder was mixed with tobacco, which a chief was induced to smoke. Under its influence in the story, the chief gave his daughter, Ishkamatuk, to the sorcerer. The second, The Magic Mushrooms, is a much more important story. It tells how two brothers in a time of famine chase a deer through the forest. The chase was long and hard and made difficult by many obstacles. Finally, they lost sight of the deer, but stopping to rest, they discovered a gaping hole in the surface of a rock ledge. Through this hole, they could see an idyllic land, warm and sunny, although it was cold and wintry outside where they were. Scattered over a meadow, they saw clumps of succulent red mushrooms, in his words, interspersed between small shrubs, used to relieve his hunger. As his hunger abated, he was engulfed by a sense of tranquility. However, as this happened, he became, under the horrified eyes of his brother, a bright red mushroom himself. Fixing in his memory the spot where his transformed brother now stood, the still human brother ran for help. He came upon a medicine man and asked for aid. The medicine man gave the boy a magic arrow and a skin bag. Swift Current was instructed to fill the pouch with sacred sand and to kill an eagle with the arrow. From the eagle, he was to pluck three feathers and attach them to the medicine bag. He was then to pick the mushroom which his brother had become and sprinkle the sand over it. He did as he was told, and his brother was restored to his original form. We have learned from Morisot through an intermediary. Morisot has declined to answer any of Gordon Wasson's communications, that Schwartz shortened and altered the original. The enchanted world discovered by the brothers was actually the land of the dead, and the mushrooms are the food of the dead. The land of the dead was, in his thought, to be an actual place. At the time of the story, it was located at Fort Francis in Ontario. The two brothers came across a deserted village, which at night became inhabited by the spirits of the dead. Looking inside the houses, the brothers could see their ancestors having a feast around the fire, eating the mushrooms with much laughter and horseplay. At one point during the proceedings, the shaman got up in the middle of the gathering and pissed on everybody. Now that's an important detail, and it's isolated there. It's not put in an appropriate context. But I'll have you remember that the Siberians reuse Amanita muscaria through drinking the urine of those who have ingested it, passing it on through many people. So at least that point is very suggestive. The other thing that I'd like you to keep in mind is the essential similarity of the structure of all these legends. And as a matter of fact, if you've done any reading in the subject of shamanism, you can pretty well make out that this is the archetypical shamanic experience, the quest, normally up a mountain, the descent through a hole to a supernatural land, the happy nature of the things which occur there. Very many of them are detailed in Gordon Wasson's Siberian materials in the appendices to his book Soma. There is another reference to magic mushrooms in amongst the Amerindian groups of the North. And that's with the Western Abenaki. A man called Gordon Day, who's in the position of Eastern Canada ethnologist, wrote Gordon that he has found the magic mushrooms in a myth of the Western Abenaki, set, as he says, early in their cosmological period. The Western Abenaki are a group of Algonquin tribes that came together to reside at the mission of Saint-François in Quebec. Mr. Day preferred not to make his field notes accessible until he had worked them up for publication. But until now, this has not happened. So what it appears like is that the use of Amanita muscaria, the muscueta, is very likely a pan-Algonquian practice, which is most clearly detailed and carried by the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe. Well, I think it's important for your understanding to know who the Ojibwe are, the Anishinaabe are, and what their religion is like, at least to a certain extent. And Kuwait no kwe, and I'll try to do that for you. there's an initial difficulty in describing the Anishinaabeg because we don't quite know which groups we are talking about. This is because the French, who made contact first, and the English and Americans who wrested the territory from them, assigned a name, willy-nilly, to nearly every band they encountered. The French met Ojibwe at Sault Ste. Marie and called that group Soto. Ojibwe groups in northwestern Ontario were lumped in with their neighbors, the Cree. The name Ojibwe, appearing in variants Ojibwe, Chippewa, Ojibwa, took on a catch-all nature, although it was probably only the designation of a subset, and so it went. The word Ojibwe has been absurdly translated as to roast until puckered up. This wild white man's invention has for the most part been supposed to refer to moccasins, although why anybody would roast until a moccasin until puckers up escapes me. But you've read a pamphlet of the put out by the state of Michigan, which has an even more absurd etymology. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Someone had the idea that this roasted until puckered up applied not to moccasins, but to captives.
Your diet really isn't like that, is it?
It hasn't been so far.
Ojibwe, the name for the tribe, Ojibwe.
I think that most people, the few people who bothered to write on the subject, have accepted the fact that...
Captives.
Captives.
War captives.
Cupcakes. This was suggested by an official pamphlet put out by the state of Michigan that perhaps... did not refer to moccasins, but to captives.
Yes. Well, what then is a more reasonable derivation of the name?
Well, it would seem that the Ojibwe, the word that's used to refer to writing on birch bark, would be much more reasonable for a number of reasons. This was one characteristic by which our people very proudly delineated themselves from the other woodland tribes. And it would seem, you know, someone coming in to observe the group, but it would seem a rather remarkable thing. It really wasn't. It's been going on for a long time, but I could see how to somebody from the outside it might seem. And I'm sure that that's the source of it.
And that's corroborated to a certain extent, isn't it, by the name which other Indian groups referred to the Anishinaabeg?
Well, yes and no. I think that a lot of scholars are sort of agreeing on that now because of the extreme interest in the hieroglyphs. But the one you're referring to is the hand sign, isn't it?
That's right.
Other groups who did not speak the Algonquian language and who shared with us the hand sign so that we could communicate, made a sign indicating the use of the birch bark as to represent the Ojibwe people, which certainly is appropriate because we used it then and still use it for just about everything, roofs and kettles and containers and whatever you want to mention.
Well, who are the Anishinaabeg, then?
The Anishinaabeg are the people who, in times past, had the same religion, spoke the same language, lived in the same woodland ways, and were all descendants of the people who took the Great Negus Migration.
And they're in three groups, aren't they?
Well, they would be in three groups if you just want to count the largest groups, as the Potawatomis, the people of the Place of the Fire, the Odawa, the traders, and the Ojibwe.
The Chippewa.
the Chippewa. But then you have to also count the pillagers and the Salteer and the Leech Lakers and the White Earthers and the Red Lakers and all the other people that were lumped in with it.
The pillagers.
Yeah, beautiful name. Wouldn't you love to, they have to get up and swear, I am a pillager. Some people have to do that. I have to get up and swear, I am an Indian, and I know I'm not an Indian. No, they didn't come from India.
Well, then, so there are many groups, again, confused by the white man, who are stretched over a fairly large geographical area, bounded in the east by Lake Ontario, in the south by the southern borders of Michigan and Wisconsin, in the north somewhat beyond James Bay in northern Canada, and in the west by the Qu'Appelle River Basin in Saskatchewan. And as Gordon has pointed out, the Anishinaabeg are a branch of the Algonquian-speaking peoples. They share a culture and a parent language with the Mi'kmaq in Maine, the Lenni Lenape in Delaware, the Alabama, the Montagnais of the St. Lawrence, and the Woods Cree of northern Saskatchewan, to name only a few. No other Native American language group is so extensive in North America. Now, we're going to be using some words and terms that you probably ought to have defined for you. He has already said one or two of them. One is Manido, and perhaps you can explain to us what a Manido is.